That noise, what's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
Why has an editor been allowed to turn a decent journal into this? A disgusting tabloid, pandering to the passions of the base morons.
I don't want any more economists, sages, or oracles bombinating over our cables. I want a reporter.
Boy, there was a slash at editors there. Weren't you an editor, Skip?
Yeah. Only said sweet things about me. And
aren't you an editor, Eli Sanders?
Associate editor.
Oh, I see. You tried that one.
He associates with us.
Exactly.
And you were an editor.
Yes.
Wow. You guys just had a big cut laid on you.
We can take it.
This is the Week in Review on KUOW. Knut Berger writes the Mossback column at crosscut.com. Eli Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger. Joni Balter is a news analyst. It's good to see you all again.
Good morning.
Good nice to be here.
Interesting news this week, and I want to start with the news of the death penalty. Here's how Governor Inslee introduced his decision to suspend executions while he's in office.
There have been too many doubts raised about capital punishment. There are too many flaws in this system today. And when the ultimate decision is death, there is too much at stake to accept an imperfect system.
Skip, what did you make politically of that? And then we'll get to the question of just the death penalty itself.
Well, I think he's doing something interesting, and it took me a little while to figure it out.
Did I call you Skip again?
Yeah, Knut.
Knut, also known as Skip.
Look, if he has two names, he's going to have to cope.
You have to give me two microphones
That's right.
for each personality. It took me a while to figure it out because at first what I thought he was saying was that his objections to the death penalty weren't moral but were technical. In other words, that the system wasn't fair and therefore he wanted to suspend. But I think in that is a moral decision that he's made, which is he used to be in favor of the death penalty. He no longer is. He's now in a position where he wasn't before, where he would have to sign the document that would send somebody to the execution chamber. He's not willing to do that. And the reason is that he believes the system is not equally applied, as he mentioned, that there are flaws in the system. I at first thought that maybe the conversation he wanted to open up was there a way to fix that imperfect system? In other words, if that's the objection, are technical objections, some of those can be addressed, things having to do with budgets, things having to do with way sentences are determined and that kind of thing. But it turns out that really isn't the case. He has become a death penalty opponent. He's not making a decision to let those on death row off the hook, although on a temporary basis he is. He's basically said, well, I'm governor. Nobody's going to get executed. And he's trying to open up what he calls this broader conversation or have the state enter the broader conversation. I think the last time as a state we weighed in on the death penalty was in the 1970s when we passed a referendum approving the death penalty after it had been suspended for many years. I think like with a lot of issues, there's an opportunity here to take people's temperature as to where they are on it.
Let me. I want to get you guys to follow up, but since you brought up that point, and that analysis dovetails with, here's Mark Rowe, he's the Snohomish County prosecutor responding to Inslee's decision.
I think we have a very well-oiled anti-death penalty industry in this state and in this country. I think it's a strategy and a very successful one that they have to make it as time-consuming and as expensive as possible. And they struck gold with what Governor Inslee said yesterday. I think if you have real problems with how long it takes and how expensive it is, that's what you should address. I don't think you just say, you guys have made it so time-consuming and expensive, you win, that even though the voters believe we should have this, I'm going to take it off the table.
I think that's very eloquent for the opposition. That's a very clear, and I heard this earlier in the week, I think on KUOW,
on the show The Record,
where he was explaining what this does to the prosecutors and all of that. On the political side for Jay Inslee, this is just another thing to think about. I think that, you know, Jay Inslee, even his supporters would say he had a pretty slow start as governor, a lot of sort of life happening to him instead of him happening to it, you know. And so this is him coming out strong in a what's going to be a pretty quiet legislative session and saying, this is one of my new values. I've changed my position and I'm just going to do what a governor can do. I'm not going to address the law. And I'm not going to even, you know, let these people out completely. Just during my time, there will not be any executions. And, you know, in some states, think about the state that he's doing this in. In some states, maybe Texas, this would be grounds for the death penalty for a governor to do this. But here it is not. Here it's grounds for a big, huge discussion about where we are. Take the temperature, as Skip said, in this year. 2014, and his action is strong, and it sort of gives us sort of a governor in charge kind of a thing. And so hard not to note that.
And it puts him in line with, or I would think it puts him in line, I guess we'll find out, with the feeling among the people who really elected him, which is the people in the Tri-County area here, King County, Pierce, and Snohomish. I would guess that you would find strong opposition to the death penalty here. I have a complaint about the framing of death penalty opponents as an industry, which suggests some sort of profit motive. I don't think that that's anything close to the motive. I think they have a moral objection to the death penalty, and I think they've articulated that case very strongly. And to suggest that working against a system that has been proven to unfairly and, in the end, unlawfully, in other words, wrongly, execute people for crimes that sometimes they didn't commit, to compare that to some sort of industry that's seeking profit is wrong. It's a moral objection.
Here's what Sarah wrote us. We have zero legitimate moral and ethical justification for using the arm of the state to commit murder. I'm just curious, since this is now a discussion, what's your thoughts? Weekinreview at KUOW.org. Send us some emails. We'd like to read them. You can also send us an email and tell us what you think about this issue. Weekinreview at KUOW.org. You were going to say? He was going to say?
He was going to say.
Well, here's my question. You've been looking at the, let's look a little bit at the arguments that are being made, because these arguments come and go. We've seen governors in other states take these actions. And part of the argument is it's implicitly unfair when you look at the statistics. Who gets executed and who doesn't get executed shows a discrepancy by race across America.
Yeah, well, you know, the governor's not making that case as being an issue in Washington. The legal decisions so far don't seem to suggest that there's a racial bias. Most people executed in this. First of all, we don't execute very many people. There have been, I think, 78 people executed in the last 110 years. Only 9 people have even been executed within our lifetime of those sitting around this table from 1956 on. You know, it is not a machine here, you know, in the sense of it's rare. And the issue, there are two issues to consider. One is the issue of how it's applied generally, if you take all the states. The other is how is it applied in Washington state, to what degree, if there's a bias in the system, it's that we've never executed a woman. It's mostly white men, and it's done very infrequently. And one could argue that that is the system working, that people who have had the people who are on death row are a limited number of people. They're going through a lot of appeals. Some of those are successful in terms of getting their sentences changed to life imprisonment. So it's, you know, we're not Texas.
Well, that's one of the interesting things here. I was thinking about what Jay Inslee said, and he seemed to be talking about describing more the nationwide system, which does have a lot of unfairness built into it. And that's why I was wondering what Skip's stats were, because he looked up those stats. In Washington, you know, the race component, and the governor didn't mention this, is not really at play here. What was the number, Skip? That's what I was looking to you for. The biggest percentage were white men, right?
That's correct. Out of 78 people executed since 1904, 66 men, white men, seven African-Americans or black men, two Asians, two Hispanics, and one Eskimo is how it's listed. He was an Aleut.
Eskimo.
Yeah, and so for folks who argue this on both sides, when you look at it, the death penalty in Washington has been applied very sparingly. And in cases where when you read the details of the cases, you're oh my gosh, this is a horrible creature.
I like the way Knut put it earlier. It can seem, and this is probably politically strategic, it can seem that Inslee has a technical or procedural quibble here, but when you look at it, it does start to sound like what he actually has is a moral objection, which is an absolutely fair thing to have. A lot of people across the country and in the state have a moral objection to the death penalty. And so what he's effectively done is commuted the sentences of people on death row to life in prison for the duration of his term as governor. That's what's going on here. And it will be interesting to see whether the debate actually arises and whether it moves forward on these technical grounds, which may be safer politically for Inslee, or on the moral ground, which I agree with Knut, I think is probably where he's coming from.
By the way, since you mentioned it, 1,265 individuals executed in Texas since 1819, just by way of comparison.
So that's much different, right? And also consider the approach of the governor. He didn't propose a bill. He didn't, fire up the legislature into some huge debate whereby, they would have their hearings and their moments. He just said this isn't going to happen while he's the governor.
But he's creating political room for people in the legislature to move now. Reuben Carlisle and others who have proposed previously bills to end the death penalty now have a little more maneuvering room as a result of this. They can join elements of the conversation. They can propose legislation. I think having that conversation is a fine thing to do. I think that, as with gay marriage or legalizing marijuana or whatever, I think there are issues that deserve to get discussed and everybody do a gut check based on what this generation thinks. Personally, I'm actually in favor of a limited, rarely used death penalty. I think it works pretty well in Washington State. Whether I'm in the minority or majority, I don't know. I'm certainly in the minority of probably Seattle liberals. But I think that I like the way Inslee has approached what is essentially a moral issue without preaching. In other words, it's an act of his own conscience. Other governors have had to make similar decisions and have chosen to enforce the law as it is written. I think Christine Gregoire is an example. There was at least one execution on her watch, and she was not in favor of the death penalty.
And what we would need, if there was to be any change, is legislative action, at least the initial step. And I don't think we're going to see any of that from this legislature this session. But perhaps what happens is a bill is introduced maybe next session or this session and next session, and then ultimately goes to the voters as a referendum. And maybe we get another statewide gut check, as Knut is saying, on record about this.
Well, that's exactly right, because there's not going to be time. This session's supposed to end March 13th. They're barely getting to what was on their agenda, so they don't have time for the death penalty. But it could be one of those long-term things whereby it sort of aired this year, and then somebody like Reuben Carlisle or somebody like that introduces a bill next year during the longer session. I could see that.
I just wanted to say, since you had brought this up and I'd asked that question about race, and I was thinking about what I had read and what I had known, and actually Hubert Locke, who has been a long time public figure in the state, he served in a lot of different capacities. He actually wrote in Crosscut, September 16th, Washington State's racist death penalty, and his argument is towards the end. I'm not going to read you the whole thing. Since 1981, the majority of those sentenced to death have been white, but only two of those white sentencees have been executed. The rest have had their death sentences vacated, lesser sentence imposed. This leaves us with the current death row population. Eight men awaiting execution in Walla Walla, four are black. All were sentenced to death by all white juries. In other words, One half of Washington's death row populace is black, in a state where black residents are less than 4% of the population. But, I mean, that is the calculation that people make when they try to look at the fairness of a terminal option.
That's true. And it certainly there are many ways in which the system has been biased against African-Americans and minorities. So looking at it in that context is completely legitimate. But also, if you take a snapshot at any particular point in time, you're not necessarily going to see a complete demographic reflection of what's going on over time. And that would be, I think, a point of discussion back. I think if you look at the list of the nine men on death row now, you look at the crimes they committed, these aren't people who murdered. These are the most kind of heinous crimes. All murdered women. Some also murdered children. Most of them multiple murders. One a corrections officer. The horrendous thing that happened up in Monroe. And even Inslee isn't debating their innocence or the justice of those particular verdicts. He, you know, even Inslee said they get no sympathy from me, you know. So the question is whether you let them live because of these larger issues of human perfectibility or whether they have just sentences that should be carried out.
I don't doubt that Jay Inslee's position is evolving, but also his circumstance has changed. We remember sometimes when we heard about his position on the death penalty, he was the congressman from the 4th District who eventually was tossed out by Doc Hastings, who we can talk about that later. This week said he's not coming back after 2014.
What about the – go ahead.
I was just going to say quickly that one of the arguments for the death penalty, as I understand it, is that it has some sort of deterrent effect. And if you remove that – then you will have more crime, more violence. And so we have an opportunity to see. Inslee is essentially conducting an experiment over the next 4 years, knowing that there will be no death penalty under his watch. Does crime go up?
Well, actually, that deterrent, or even death penalty proponents don't believe the deterrent argument. That's been discredited years ago. And I went back and looked at arguments that were made by professors and sociologists, you know, even 20 years ago, people were saying the deterrent argument doesn't hold water. And so I don't think that will be the issue. I think Inslee's has more to do with the finality of that particular punishment and the fact that you can't ever go back and correct it should you find out later that a mistake was made.
Republicans held a press conference afterwards, a few of them, Steve O'Bann, Jay Rodney, and Kirk Pearson. I question the timing of the announcement by the governor, Rodney said. I wonder what his motives are. But then that's all he said. He said, I don't want to speculate. I don't want to assign motives. Is there any – so we have this dialogue now. We have this discussion. Maybe it goes to the – maybe the legislature takes it up. More likely it percolates for a while and then something shows up in 2015 or 2016 as an initiative. Is there any political benefit or danger for either side?
Well, I do think that Jay Inslee has risked aggravating 39 prosecutors in 39 counties, and some of that we did see because they used, you know, they have that on their plate of something they have to weigh. And so the governor's sort of gone around them. They will still go ahead. They've said that. They will still go ahead and in the cases they deem appropriate seek the death penalty, knowing that the governor sort of tamped down on that.
All right. We're going to take a break, and then we'll come back. This is the Week in Review on KUOW.
I thought this was the proper way to use the reprieve authority to allow the state to have a conversation about this and to recognize that as currently applied in the state of Washington, this decision is not a deterrent. It is not cost-effective. It causes all kinds of grief for multiple decades, and it's not consistent with who we are as a state to have a system that is not accomplishing those goals.
You're listening to The Week in Review from KUOW. I'm Steve Scherer. Knute Berger is the author of Pugetopolis. Eli Sanders is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. Joni Balter is a news analyst for KUOW and at Bloomberg. And as the host of Civic Cocktail, is a longtime analyst of the city's and the state's politics. How's that? That's pretty nice.
That's getting there.
So I got a few emails. First of all, one from Deke. Name a case in which someone was executed for a crime they didn't commit. Well, I think you got to look at Innocence Project's records to see that. Some Innocence Project's records have gone in to look at people who later were found to be unjustly executed. But there were more than a few people who almost were. I have mixed feelings about the death penalty, but I absolutely respect the governor's choice here. If he doesn't want to execute, then that's his prerogative. And as a voter, I respect that. Thanks. That's from Melissa. And Stephen writes, executing a murderer doesn't punish him or her. It lets him off the hook. Make them work hard and regret every day of their lives till they die a natural death or until one of their colleagues offs them.
I think that you can toss out the humane argument.
Yeah. And then Beam writes, if Gary Ridgway, Green River Killer, didn't get it, why should anyone?
Okay, that is a great point. And I think people who might be on the fence about the death penalty, I think people like Gary Ridgway, it's sort of like if you don't execute him, then what's the death penalty for? And in that case, the prosecutor made a complicated calculation and was able to use the death penalty to get, quote, closure for 40-some families who wanted—
The threat of the death penalty.
The threat of the death penalty. And it now, as we've learned since, at least if you believe him, he didn't come completely clean. He's laughing from his jail cell. He will not pay what many people think is the ultimate price for an absolutely horrendous situation. But I can fully understand why that then would say, well, gee, this guy only killed two people. He only raped and murdered half a dozen people. Why should he get off? And I think that is a complicated question in that the court system doesn't guarantee an equal outcome for everybody. And that has to do with whether you got a good lawyer, what the technicalities of your case and how it was presented are. It has to do with what a particular jury of your peers thought in the courtroom on a particular day. So you're never going to have a perfect system that way.
That case gives Jay Inslee the line that he delivered, that it's applied unevenly. That's a perfect example of what he said.
And it goes back to another rationale that I think Knute was alluding to, which is the death penalty is for leverage, I guess, for prosecutors to get more out of a defendant that they feel they should be getting more out of.
All right. Go ahead.
I would just say I think one of the stronger arguments against using the death penalty is to say that if you're using it so infrequently that you've only executed 9 people in the last 50 years or some number like that, you're essentially executing people symbolically. And do we really need that symbol? In other words, you're not really, to Inslee's point, you're not really executing everybody who might deserve it. So is the moral cost of those 9 lives, how is that weighed? And do you just say, well, we can live without that symbol?
And, to go back to the discussion we were having before the break and then a little bit off the air, if the deterrent effect is not an argument and you can get past the idea that prosecutors need the death penalty as leverage in certain cases, then what are you really left with? Just this kind of eye for an eye argument for it. And how is society really any safer if the person is put to death than if they are in prison for life?
All right. Well, here's just first of all, just to answer in a quick, while we're on the air, search. Carlos de Luna was put to death in December 1989 for murder in Corpus Christi. He didn't commit the crime. His case reminds us of the glaring flaws of capital punishment. That's from The Atlantic. I got about nine of those just looking at it. So I think we could probably, and you'll have to read the article to see if you trust The Atlantic reporting on that or not. And here's two emails. I'll read three, actually. It's shocking in light of DNA exonerations and in the age of the Innocence Project for a person to advocate for quicker and cheaper death penalty cases, as Mr. Rowe does, we heard earlier from Snohomish County Prosecutor Mark Rowe. Eli is right. There's no anti-death penalty industry, just a moral stance and one required under our Constitution, which requires effective assistance of counsel. And that's from Natalie, who's a public defender in Snohomish County. And just a part of Stewart's email. The moral question of the death penalty results from a long history of confusion over whether there is such a thing as correction or rehabilitation, or if this is still about vengeance and wrath. And Walter writes, greetings. Now that the governor has shown he has a spine, maybe he can do something actually progressive in Olympia. And Carol says that as well. I'm surprised and moved by the news of one high government leader taking what appears to be a non-expedient, personally moral position. Interesting on the debut day of House of Cards Season 2. I don't know if you guys watch that or not. All right, we'll leave that. Let me ask you about just a quick taste of what's happening with our friend Bertha.
Bearings. I wish she wasn't named Bertha. What's happening?
Maybe we should just change that now.
We're going to change it
the
to
the tunnel machine.
The Canadian one is, you know, Excalibur or something like that. But how
although
did this,
that's a sword that got stuck in a rock.
Yeah, but how did this get all put upon the only female mayor in Seattle's history? Just yeah,
there you
that
go.
Whole gender thing.
There's that whole gender pay equity raising
its head. Gets to me. You know, can't even pay the women the same. Oh my gosh, what's going on with Bertha? Everything and nothing. Bertha's sort of messed up right now. Clearly the seals on Bertha are not working, and so there's this effort, and we may hear more about it today, to figure out how to approach Bertha. It go in from the back, the front, to figure out how to fix these seals. It's going to be expensive.
Wasn't it interesting that they had a plan for the seals because they knew they might be.
They knew the seals were, you know, apparently this happens, and that's one of the stories about Excalibur, that these seals are not the best part of the machine, apparently, because they seem to get messed up, and they planned for it, and they knew about it. And now we're going to have a report on how to fix them, and we're going to have a battle royale about who shall pay for this. The state folks, Jay Inslee again, says the state isn't paying for this. This is a design-build contract, and those folks know how to fix this, and they will fix it. And guess what? Then it's on their tab. One of the most interesting things I read about Bertha this week was that the company that made Bertha is liable up to 1,300 feet. Bertha's at about 10, 25 feet in. And then the contractor, STP, takes over after 1,300 feet for just responsibility. So did they anticipate this or what?
By the way, it was the end of his press conference. Our friend Essex Porter did shout out a question to Jay Inslee about Bertha.
Do you have that this could get done?
I'm sorry?
How much confidence do you have that this tunnel can be built?
I have enough confidence to say we are going to insist that the taxpayers are protected in this state. We are going to insist that tunnel either gets built on time or the contractor is going to be financially responsible to the citizens of this state for every single penny of cost overruns that contractor could eventually be responsible for.
Any thoughts on where we're at now? The I told you so's are starting to raise their heads, I'm sure.
Well, of course they are. And, I mean, the Seattle Times had a great story this morning about a tunnel boring machine bearing problem up in Canada, the Excalibur machine up in Ontario, so which gave a window on how the process of fixing this goes. The idea that this is a small problem, of course, is now completely blown away because any method of fixing the seals. And we should find out more today. But there's also a real question as to whether the bearing needs to be replaced. If there was contamination getting in through the seals, it's very easy to wreck the bearing. So
yeah,
they do have a replacement bearing. But to me, the scale of it is what I've been so struck by. They have to okay, Bertha's 60 feet underground. That's to get to the top of Bertha. But Bertha's six stories tall. So the pit is 120 feet deep. through water-saturated fill and soil. So they're going to have to
We're Americans, Skip. We can conquer any technological problem.
Well, in a way, that's true. I mean, they are not going to pull the plug on this project. They are going to fix the machine. They're going to get it running again. They're going to finish the tunnel. And the whole question is, how big is the price tag? How long are the delays? How do those delays affect other projects like the seawall, like the waterfront redo? And then the big question is, who's going to pay for it all? That will be in litigation for years, because you've got the builder of the machine, you have tunnel partners, you have the city, you have the state, and all the insurance companies that are in that mix too. And as was pointed out in that Seattle Times story, the bill paying decision from the court up in Canada was what, 14 years later? 14 years.
And somebody in there said, you just keep digging. You do not settle the finances first. You just keep digging. And one other thing here, at least that digger up there wasn't named Celine or Dion, yeah, or a Canadian singer.
By the way, 14 years. We'll be about getting Sound Transit 2 light rail at that point,
but,
won't we?
But another point here is about the pipe. You know, remember on this show many a time we said, so it got stuck because it ate the pipe. It didn't get stuck because it ate the pipe. Nobody knows about the pipe. The pipe is a key point here, because when Jay Inslee comes out and says this, the contractor's going to pay for it, it's sort of like, yeah, dot, 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 maybe. What depends on who left that pipe there and how much of a part of the story it is.
Right. Depends on whether the pipe caused the bearing problem or the bearing caused the stuck problem and the pipe was an ancillary problem that was still a problem but not the problem. So it will be complicated.
I was once on a jury in a civil case that was over whether a rock crusher had been broken down due to neglect or sabotage. It was a 2-week trial. I mean, it had every bit of drama, every Perry Mason had, people collapsing on the stand, people, I mean, and it was basically an insurance company versus a machine owner. And when you got in, we had the people from CH2M Hill and all the experts in there arguing. This is just was a simple rock crusher. The level of technical debate about what made this thing go wrong. And Bertha is like exponentially more complicated with many more players. So it's going to be, I can't say the word I want to use, but
I think it had something to do with peanut butter and fudge brownies at one point exchange. Yes.
All right. Cluster bars.
Knute Berger writes the Mossback column at Crosscut. Eli Sanders, associate editor of The Stranger. Joni Balters, a news analyst. You know, you can listen to The Week in Review if you missed it as a podcast. Just find the podcast and download it at KOW.org or on iTunes. We'll take a break. We're going to come back, talk about income inequality, affordability, and how you set your roots into your home. And if you have a story, send us a story. How did this place become your home? It's Joe Strummer, by the way, that music from his album. And, you know, if you want to get the honey, don't go killing all the bees. That's the name of that song, Johnny Appleseed. All right, we're going to talk, because Eli did so amazing last year, taking three disparate elements and putting them together in a brilliant essay, we will again see if we can put the three different ideas together. Which
last
I think,
week?
He said last year, but you
Oh, last week.
Did
I say last
too.
Year? You
no,
did
I
it last,
last
year.
Week.
You did it every week.
Right.
Last week, yes.
Indeed.
So affordability in a city and housing and transportation. But I want to start with what President Obama was talking about when he talked about the minimum wage, what his underlying idea is.
I'm going to do what I can. Congress should do what it needs to do. I will not give up on this fight, no matter how long it takes. I'm going to do what I can. Congress should do what it needs to do. I will not give up on this fight, no matter how long it takes. America deserves a raise. Working families deserve to know some more economic security in their own lives. We've got to create new jobs, strengthen the middle class, build new ladders of opportunity for folks working their way into the middle class, just like these folks are doing right here. There are millions of Americans who could just use a little bit of boost.
That's President Obama. I'm sorry, interrupted him. So That's the overarching theme we're hearing, right? But in the nuts and bolts, it's questions like what the city council is facing in terms of affordable housing, which is a conversation that they're having at city council. Mike O'Brien has some ideas about what should be done, and that's where it gets sticky. So, for example, affordable housing, part of that was we saw people protesting the Microsoft bus, saying that all this stuff is coming in, and these are, what did he say, what did the protesters say, make Seattle a yuppie playground, and rents are high. Maybe it's not the tech jobs making housing high, but rents are high because of this. You know, that's, we want to have a higher minimum wage because people get paid more, but how can they afford to live in a city?
Well, America deserves a raise. You could tell when the comment went by that is a campaign theme for 2014 congressional elections. And as you know, around the country, so many different states and cities like Seattle are considering raising the minimum wage. And so what happened here is very reminiscent of San Francisco, where in San Francisco the rents are really high, the costs are really high. That city is also considering raising its minimum wage. But there have been protests against the buses that take the workers there to Silicon Valley because the workers who live in San Francisco are sort of pushing other people out. And here we mustered a sort of a Seattle version of that, which was rather small by comparison. There were either two or four people who stopped. By one picture, there were four, but by visuals, there were two, and they stopped the Microsoft connector. It was on Capitol Hill, I think.
Had a good flyer.
And so this is becoming it's different from years ago, during the depths of the recession, where all we talked about was people just need a job, any job. Now they need a job that has a raise with it.
Or where they or they need housing. And part of the argument that the difficulty in this city is, for example, a push to stop the construction of microhousing or apartments in various neighborhoods because people that live there think it's going to ruin their neighborhoods. But at the same time, how are we going to provide for people to afford to live in this city?
Right. I see the protests against the private fleets of buses, even though the protesters themselves are not always great at articulating their position, and even though I think in this protest they ended up also blocking a public bus. But setting that aside, if it can be set aside, I see the protests against the private bus as a part of a larger dissatisfaction with the creation of with the focus on orienting the city to private interests, to the interests of big business, to the interests of a certain class of people, so that if techies need a way to get across the lake, we have a private bus for them that's created by their companies. Meanwhile, the state doesn't have enough money to help us fund good public transportation. And if the city needs to be more desirable to people who want to work for Amazon, we will, you know, allow Amazon to build, and we will build more apartments that are affordable to people from Amazon, but we don't create policies that promote affordable housing, which is what you're talking about. And so to get to solutions, I mean, it goes back to the idea that as we are growing as a city, we don't just accept a situation in which you have neighborhoods that are completely unaffordable to certain classes of people in the downtown area, or a situation in which you just say, all right, well, we'll create a private bus system for people who can afford it and everyone else is on their own.
Or we have solutions to affordable housing, perhaps the beginnings of them, that people don't want to embrace because it violates many aspects of it. I mean, can we build affordable housing that doesn't turn into a tenement, which is the fear that people raise when they talk about the micro housing, for example. And that seems to be where people, that's the tension I see.
But the answer is yes, and we already are. The set aside apartments for a second, and there's, you know, an ongoing debate about that, but I don't see a lot of evidence of them turning into tenement slums. But we already do require developers to build affordable housing, sort of the offsets that they get for being able to build up high, and we probably don't do enough of that, but it is successful.
Well, also with the apartments, we discussed last week family-friendly downtown, but it also applies to family-friendly neighborhoods.
Right.
If you're in an apartment, it's going to be tough to stuff, two or three kids in there.
Right. So where's the money for the parks and the libraries and the community centers and the grocery stores and the schools that we also need to make it possible for people to be able to live more lightly in an urban place?
Well, one of the issues There's so many. It's so complicated because they're macroeconomic issues that we are wrestling with, but we have no control over. I mean, Microsoft, Boeing, Amazon, these are international companies that are doing business and dealing with Wall Street and those kinds of things. We have no control. These aren't just little locally owned businesses. And so we are at the mercy of a lot of economic decisions that are made way, way, way high up the chain.
All right, but go ahead, finish.
Yeah. Yet our concerns are often very local, and what the impact is on one's neighborhood or one's ability to get across town or be able to afford an apartment, much less a house. And we don't have the capacity, partly because of the laws in the United States and property rights laws and whatnot, we don't have the capacity that some countries like Canada or others have to do planning where you take an integrated approach to transit, to playgrounds, to schools, to, you know, all kinds of things. I mean, to me, a great example of that was the school district decided to go back to local schools. But does that integrate with a housing policy that says we are going to build affordable housing next to schools so that people can get an affordable two- or three-bedroom apartment near a school? No. We're in the situation where the market wants to do one thing, and the effects of the market need to be mitigated by public intervention and public action. And it's how you get those two things working together, I think, that's the trick.
So here's one more aspect of that. City Council today is voting on a proposal to limit the number of drivers working for car sharing companies. And part of the debate is about, is this a technology, the car sharing companies, this is an industry that should be disrupting the taxi industry. Here's what the CEO, John Zimmer, says.
I think Lyft is disrupting the idea that you need to drive your own car at all times. You need to own multiple vehicles in a family. That's what I think we're disrupting, not just looking at it as, oh, how does this compete with existing for-hire businesses, but what is this doing to make it easier not to own a car in Seattle?
See, that's his, I mean, yes, it's he's got a business and a business model, but that's the argument he's making, and it comes back to sort of what you're saying. What's the integration between public policy, these big ideas, and the kind of votes we're taking right on the ground?
Well, at first, when I saw what the city council was doing with this, I thought, boy, they seem out of step with the next generation. They seem sort of fuddy-duddy to me about this, that they wouldn't sort of integrate and bring in this new system of providing rides for people. But there are some really legitimate insurance issues and safety issues. There was a death in San Francisco, a driver apparently off duty, but still, you know.
And all that stuff. I get all that stuff, and they have responses, and the city has responses. But I guess, and so that's legitimate.
Yes.
But at the same time, those are policies that can be taken care of.
Correct.
These guys are arguing whether they're bringing something to make the city a more affordable place for people who don't have as much money or not. I mean, if you don't want to own a car.
Well, and they are bringing that, and that's why the city council has a very delicate balancing act to do here. They need to err on the side of public safety, but they also need to err on the side of a new innovation that comes into your city that speaks to a lot of people who don't have a car or don't want a car, for that matter.
And that doesn't too badly disrupt a ladder up into the middle class or, you know, a sustainable living in the city, which has been driving a taxi cab and is not a ladder that's going to be provided, I don't think, for drivers by Lyft. I want to come back.
They argue they can, but go ahead. Come back to what you say.
I want to come back to something Knut was saying, which is the idea that we are kind of at the mercy in terms of our public policy of what Boeing and Amazon and Microsoft want from us. And that has definitely been on display as an attitude from the state legislature. Just look at the $8 billion Boeing deal. But I think it is not the case. And it's very, very dangerous for us to just throw up our hands and say, yes, this is true. We're at the mercy of these companies. In fact, if we wanted better public transportation policies, if we wanted more affordable housing, and we saw that the answer was that we simply need more money, then we could look at the tax avoidance schemes that are being perpetrated by Microsoft, by Amazon, by all of these companies that we feel like we have to jump for, and say, wait a minute, can we propose a tax structure that would have these companies paying an amount that is reasonable and would result in a situation where we don't have to have a private bus fleet for Microsoft, but have a public bus fleet that works for everyone, Microsoft employees and lower wage earners.
All right, I'm leaving it there for now because it's a fascinating issue and we'll be talking about it for a while. I wanted to bring Luke Burbank in, who's host of LiveWire that's on KOW tonight at 9. He also is a guest on the that crazy talk show called Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Hi, Luke.
I don't know if I like that transition.
Yeah.
This is fascinating. Now let's get to something.
Yeah.
Now
well,
let's get
here,
to something.
I'm using you as a jumping off point. Where were you born?
I was born in Humboldt County, California.
And
General Hospital.
What do you call your home now?
Oh, Seattle, most definitely.
And how do you know it's your home? I mean, what place, what idea, what is it that makes it your home, other than that you own a house here? I mean, something a little deeper than that.
Well, I mean, I cried when the Seahawks won the Super Bowl. I looked at my little brother crying, and then I cried. So maybe I was more crying about him crying, but I felt
very connected. It's like sneezing. It's contagious.
Yeah, going around. I grew up listening to Wayne Cody on do Sportsline at night. I remember going to Herphy's with my dad on special occasions when I'd help him out doing sign making jobs. When I look around this city, I mourn all of the places that don't exist any longer, like Leilani Lanes in Greenwood. And
yes.
So
oh,
that
yeah.
makes me feel like this is my home.
That's a good answer. So I did this little essay on pie, and that's what I was thinking about. And you guys, I mean, you were born here, Canute,
yes.
right? Can you give the litany like that that lets us know what your home is, that this is your home?
You know, I think I really realized it was home when I left. I lived in San Francisco for 2 years after my last year of college and my first year out of college, and which I loved. I still love San Francisco. I loved it then. It was fantastic. But I felt the draw to come back to the place that my family lived. It was family, and multiple generations of my family that drew me back and wanting to be in that place. And of course, when I got back to Seattle, I really appreciated back then in the 70s, it was affordable.
Back to that issue. Luke, I like the idea that if we cried over the Seahawks win, then now we can basically call ourselves natives.
Well, I've talked about it on this show before, but that for me was the completion of a lifelong Don Quixote-esque relationship with this football team and maybe with this city. I don't want to get too grandiose about it, but there have been a lot of ways in which it feels to me, and I've lived in New York and Los Angeles, it feels like Seattle has always been this promising, great city that was just trying to kind of get over the hump. And the Seahawks were often this kind of promising team that was trying to get over the hump. And I do feel like some demons were exorcised when they won that game, and I don't know if that means Boeing will build more jets here, or we'll pick up more industries in this part of the world. But I feel very bullish about Seattle's future for whatever reason today.
Hey, you were just in Europe, right? Did you go to any? You were in Budapest and you were in Finland. Did you do any big spa visits while you were there? I'm just curious.
I went to the Nokia world headquarters in Espoo, Finland, and we were shooting this video, and we thought it would be funny as a joke if I went in their sauna. I said, "Do you guys have a sauna here in the corporate building?" And they said, "Well, which sauna do you want to use?" Because they have multiple saunas for the executives.
I think we need to bring that to the Northwest. We need to establish a whole public sauna. Public hot tubs, public baths.
They actually have those on the Microsoft buses.
Somebody should really block those.
So that's what they should block.
That's what they were blocking.
Home? This is your home, Eli, but...
I was thinking about this. I did grow up here, so in that sense, it's home. But we were talking about this on the show last week. My parents moved out here, like a lot of people in Seattle, to get away from their home. And so I grew up here... child of parents who moved to Seattle from the Northeast for very particular reasons, thinking that this is what you did. You grew up and you came in an adult by leaving mm-hmm. the place where you were born and coming to call someplace new home, and that was you and that was your place. And so I thought that for a very long time, and I thought that I would probably not live here when I was an adult or when I figured out who I was. And I've been trying to think since watching your essay what changed. There were a lot of things that changed, but one of them was that my father died and was buried here. And after that, and it's hard to completely explain a process, but I felt a very strong connection, something like Knut is talking about, to this place.
Very interesting.
Well, that's almost better than the Seahawks.
Yeah.
That's pretty sturdy.
All right, you got any last words, Luke, on anything at all? I give you all 30 seconds.
I'm very excited about tonight's Live Wire on KUOW at 8 p.m., but I'm excited about the show we're taping in Portland tomorrow night because the Von Trapps will be there.
Oh.
And I do mean the descendants of the Von Trapps of Sound of Music fame. Their grandkids play music and are going to be on the stage with us.
Oh, that's awesome.
Well, I hope you'll do a little Julie Andrews with them.
I'm incorrigible, guys.
All right. Yes,
knew that.
You're
knew
incorrigible.
That.
All right, Luke Burbank, thanks a lot. He's host of Live Wire. You can hear it on KUOW tonight at 8. He's also got a podcast called Too Beautiful to Live. Check it out. You and I did that. You and I went from some other place to here and
we did,
decided
indeed.
It was home, knowing that our parents had been somewhere else.
Exactly.
I guess we learn a lot as we get older. Weekday is produced by Jason Magano. We get help from Ann Kane. Bernard Bellette's our engineer. Weekday. I said weekday, didn't I? We get help from Ann Kane. Week in Review is produced by those people. And Knut Berger writes at Crosscut, Eli Sanders, The Stranger, Joni Balter for KUOW and Bloomberg and other places. Thank you all. See you next week.